I want to die. I feel like I'm in that, wait, what is that? What is that, the world? Is it Pandemonia that's very hot?
Yes.
I don't know. I'm wherever it's hot. Yeah. Welcome, everybody, to Fate of Mates. you guys, we've never recorded in summer, and you are about to get a scene with me.
See, I'm all like, you guys, listen, we're having a very different experience, because right now I actually have a fleece blanket on myself.
That's insane. I just want to die. I want to turn on it, and I can't have the air conditioner on in my window. It's the first day of heat in New York City, which is always like, it sneaks up on me and I'm never prepared. And the weather in New York in the summer is just awful. And it's 85 degrees here. And we have window air conditioners because we live in a building that was built in like 1890 something. That's not hyperbole. And so we have these window air conditioners, and my window air conditioner in my office is directly behind my microphone.
Sure.
And I have been told
no
by Eric, you may not run the air conditioner while you record. So the next 4 months are going to be me sweating and being miserable in your ear holes.
You're going to have to like, we're going to be like recording in the middle of the night or something. Like you're going to call me and be like, it's 62 right now.
You guys,
let's do it.
I have this really beautiful back garden. And when the sun goes down, it's still hot, but at least it's breezy back there. I think I should just record outside.
Sure.
Everybody will just be like, and for 3 months out of the year, Sarah records outside.
The LaGuardia approach, the neighborhood dogs.
The dogs. It'll all be fine. It'll add nice like ambiance.
You know what we can call it? Faded Mates al fresco.
Oh, yay.
You can have it with like a side of barbecue and some
a glass
corn.
Of rosé. Okay, everyone, it's Faded
Mates.
You
know what? That's actually perfect because up in sky, they don't have fucking roofs. So
they don't because they're above the clouds, which it's cold up there, you guys. I don't understand. It has to be cold. They're hidden. It's a hidden like world above the clouds.
They also don't have hot showers. So clearly they're
it's
monsters.
It's miserable up there. It's terrible.
It really is some bullshit, for sure.
It's dark sky week, you guys. We just have one more book we have to get through before we get to Sweet Ruin. And that's not really a fair way of saying this, because I actually enjoyed Dark Sky more than I usually do on this reread. But it is not my fave.
I think I like it, yeah, better than most people do. I liked it, although... Sure. I've got some issues, but we'll talk.
I just think Thanos or Thronos.
Thronos.
Not Thanos. That's a different thing. I think Thronos should get the hell over himself, is frankly how I feel about this whole book.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, like, what happened is terrible. So let's get into it. I know that people have asked that we go back to recaps. So do we want to do a quick recap?
Yeah, but
you're
here's
like,
I'm
no,
like,
I don't
okay,
want
okay, but
recap.
You know what? I actually had a good idea was like just read the synopsis from the back of the book or whatever.
God,
like the
no.
blurb.
Nobody wants
no?
that. No, all first right. of all, Cressley will hate it if it happens that way because I mean, I don't think
sure.
Cressley's
okay.
listening. Hey Cressley, if you are, hey, I'm standing right, on the side of authors right now. Hey authors, everyone out there listening. Nobody right. wants to hear their cover copy read online. No
right,
one does.
Fair enough. Okay. All right. So
I get to be in charge.
Okay. Then do you want me to do it or do you want to do it?
I'm happy to do it.
Okay. You should do it.
Because we're back to Torture Island again.
We sure fucking are.
Like,
it's like Groundhog's Day, Torture Island. It's so
I know.
Long.
I had totally forgotten that we were back on Torture Island.
Yeah.
So just to recap, because we're going all over the place now. We did McGreeve and then we did The Professional. So that's why it feels like it's been forever since we were sure. on anything. But
well,
we're on Torture Island. We are returned to Torture Island at the start of Dark Sky, where, and it is, it's like, everybody's just broken out. The, like, Queen of Stonework is, like, building a mountain in the middle of Torture Island. Everyone's dying. And Caro is running through the tunnels with Malcolm and Ruby. And we've got Melanthe. Still collared with her no powers collar, captured on the way out by Thronos, who is a reckoner.
Mm-hmm.
And has been after her, we know, since at least Kiss of the Demon King and long, long, long before that. Yeah. So we are set up, but the setup is really great. It's childhood best friends slash lovers to
enemies
to lovers. So, yeah. And where the setup is, Thronos knows that Melanthe is his fated mate. He, like, knows instantly kind of when he sees her as a child. They have this, like, really beautiful childhood friendship that is clearly, like, turned to love. And they have these, like, magnificent moments inside his wings. He's a winged demon. We haven't seen wings before. So, like, I have this real vision of him as, like, old school Lucifer. Like, just with, like, those massive, like, pointed wings. And I'm not going to lie, I'm here for it. Which will surprise absolutely no one who has read my Scandal and Scoundrel. No, my what the hell book is it? My Rules of Scoundrel series. I really like a fallen angel. And I really do a lot. And so we've got, and then cut to what, 500 years later? And here we are. And he's finally, the Reckoners and the Sorcerer are mortal enemies.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And when his family discovers that he's been, like, clandestinely seeing this Sorcerer girl, they come for the Sorcerer. And Melanthe, who is queen of persuasion and is able to persuade anybody in the world to do whatever she asks them to do, is so enraged when his father kills her parents that she tells him to leap from the window down, like, into, like, a cliff, like, off a cliff, yeah, essentially, and not use his wings to fly. And he crashes to the bottom of this ravine, broken. His body is broken, and he never heals. I mean, like, parts of him, the bones set, but everything is still broken.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about this book is, and we have a special guest who's going to join us at the end of this episode, our friend Samantha Jackson, who is I don't think she's published yet, but she's been working on some romances, and she is very interested in like religion and Christianity and how it plays out in romance. And I think we're going to talk to her about some of this stuff, because what was really interesting to me this time around was how biblical this felt, right? Ugh,
it's so religious.
It's wild. So religious, yeah. And Kate Claiborne talks about it being like Paradise Lost, right? Like Milton's Paradise Lost, which I have read only bits and pieces of in like a million years ago. But I think even just our like sort of pop culture knowledge of Paradise Lost is enough to sort of see those ties and those connections.
Well, I mean, there is such an echo because, so I have read Paradise Lost more recently because I wrote the Rules of Scoundrels series, and the first book is about basically the fall of Lucifer. It's a romance novel, but imagine the devil is the hero. And that's a rogue
like
by
Paradise
any other
Lost
name.
Too, though, right?
Sure, sure. So, and there's like a party that happens at the Fallen Angel, the casino in that series every year, and it's called Pandemonium. Like, and so the kind of echoes, I was very surprised actually by how many echoes I built into my historical series, and Cressley is now building into this paranormal series that are related to Paradise Lost and Milton. And I would just add that Pandemonium, that is about to be a very important place in the series.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think we're just again seeing, we're about to move into the Moriora movement of the series. And and Cressley is clearly laying a lot of brickwork here for that. I think also this feels so religious because I actually believe that you and I have talked that we think Orion, who is the head of the Morior, we have not met any of the Morior for those of you who are reading along and have never read before, but I'm going to just sort of tease this. Jen and I have gone back and forth about whether or not we believe that Orion is sort of a is like God.
Right.
The king of, like, the sort of head of the gods.
The primordial god.
The primordial god, if you will. Yeah, perfect. That's perfect. So that would make sense that we're sort of, now we're starting to look at, like, religious, there being sort of religious archetypes in this series.
I think it's really interesting in a week where, like, evangelical, like, sort of fever dreams of crushing all of, like, women and poor people down into the earth where they belong. Reading Thronos was very hard for me this time around. I found his sort of, his righteousness and his, right, like, it, even more so now in today's, like, kind of what's going on in the world today. When I read this a year ago, I was like, meh, what a jerk. But this week, I was like, whoa. And so it makes sense that someone who is so tied to his, it's really interesting because he doesn't talk a lot about God, but he talks a lot about what's right and wrong. Mm-hmm.
Capital R, capital yes. W.
And it's really interesting because it's like religious, but not like faithful, which I thought was just like a really interesting, I don't know, like I thought, and then of course he would have to go on a religious journey, right? Like they go to hell, they go to heaven, they're literally in like the belly of the whale, like Jonah, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot going on.
Well, and let's also just lay it out there that this isn't just Paradise Lost and biblical. This is also Inferno. Literally, yes. Like Dante's, this is the end. Melanthe is Beatrice. Like she moves, she actually guides him. She's literally creating these portals, like,
yes,
into other places for him. So,
yeah. I mean, so and then it's also like really fascinating because then it's got this mix of like good old fashioned science fiction, right? Like there's dragons and, you know, the whole idea, it's a bunch of 80s movies, right? Like they reference Time Bandits. It feels like Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's right. Like it really feels like an, one of my, you know that I love Ulysses. And when you read Ulysses, you don't really ever read Ulysses by itself by James Joyce. You like have this like companion book you have along with it, which is called Ulysses Annotated. Mm-hmm. Because there's so many, the references are so thick that you need help as a reader, right? And so I feel like there could literally be like Dark Sky Annotated. Like there, I mean, talk about needing show notes. Like there are so many, it's like movies and pop cultures and things that she's referencing. And then there's all these like literary references. I mean, it's like a really interesting text. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, I think what I enjoyed about it is it does feel kind of different.
It's real. It is. I'm so glad you said that. I kept coming back to that over and over again. Like, this is a weird book for IAD. Like, there's a lot. It's interesting because it's not a weird setup at all.
No.
This kind of, like, childhood lovers, like, broken apart, or childhood friends, like, broken apart by family drama and then, like, brought back together when they're grown-ups.
It's Romeo and Juliet. It's, I mean, there's so many things this is,
I mean, like,
right?
We've seen this story again and again and again. And there's something about this that's, and I think it is that kind of higher level storytelling that's going on here where like and it's interesting because I want to talk about whether or not it works as a romance, because I think what we're seeing here is like a lot of Thronos's, this is Thronos's story as much as Melanthe is. I mean, she's learning how to harness her power and like how to do the work of being queen of persuasion, but like this is Thronos kind of throwing off the yoke of his past and quite literally like throwing off the rules of his past and the, you know, the all of the weight. I mean, the literal hair, the like hair shirt, if we're going to talk about religion, right? Like he's taking off that sort of, all of that sort of religious business and he's becoming I mean, he's not becoming human, but he is becoming human, right? Like, he's becoming more base.
And he's also becoming a king, right? And I think that that's another part of it that I find really interesting. I mean, kind of interesting is, like, especially when you look at, like, stories of royalty. I mean, so much of romance is really, like, a mining, like, British aristocracy, right? Like, think about the power of, like, the Regency and how many, like, and a lot of those stories are about, like, mad kings and kids who are too young taking over the throne and not really knowing what's going on. And how do you learn to do that when all of the advisors are, like, not to be trusted? And in a lot of ways, I feel like Thronos is sort of, in order to be the, like, the true good king of the Reckoners, he has to, like, unlearn all the things that he felt so smugly secure in.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's, like, sort of an interesting journey. Like, we, you know, you and you talk all the time about, like, you have to be king, right? Like, he literally
is going to be king. Yeah.
And even though Rydstrom is a king and is kind of fighting for that lost kingdom, he was good all along.
Mm.
Thronos thought he was good, or thought the Reckoners were good, and then has to grapple with, like, oh shit, we're not.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it goes back to again and again, and I feel like I should have come to this long before McGreeve, but welcome to my life. I don't. Sometimes it takes me a long time to get there. But, like, again, it's that story of identity, that story of, like, what is your truth? And, like, how, and have you been honest about what your truth is? And I mean, I think, I also really love, I want to get to Pandemonium.
Yeah.
Because I love Pandemonium so much, and I love so much of what happens there. So Melanthe basically has these, like, powers that are on the fritz, and they're on the fritz because of the Reckoners, because she has spent her entire life as a sorceress healing Sabine, who is now Rydstrom's queen. She's healed Sabine again and again and again, after the Reckoners have come for her. So, and they've, you know, like, there's this sort of graphic moment where she refers to the fact that, like, at some point a Reckoner found them and, like, flew Sabine, like, way up into the air and then dropped her from a height, and she, like, crushed her skull. And, like, she had to be, and Melanthe has been, like, persuading Sabine to heal over the entirety of their sisterhood. Like, and this is all because of him and his people. And so there's a lot of, like, rage. But also we know that Melanthe has the power to open portals. We learned that in Kiss of the Demon King. And so she's able, so they end up having to move between, like, from location to location.
You know what I actually thought myself thinking was that this was in some ways, like we've talked about leveling up all the time, right? We very much enjoyed
the Amazing Race.
This is an amazing race mm-hmm, story, but mm-hmm. instead of being on Earth, it's through realms.
Yeah.
And I found it way more, I loved it because yeah. I felt like I could also, like, just enjoy it as pure fantasy rather than sort of like thinking about what it, like, the politics of, like, having the Amazing Race be, like, white Lorians throughout the world but not experiencing people.
Sure.
And so I found myself that I could really, like, enjoy the, like, it's truly magical, whereas in the Amazing Race they're just after magical items.
Yes.
But now it's, like, after, like, it's actual magic, and I loved it.
Well, and what we've done is we've gone from Murdoch and Danny's, like, starting to, like, fuss with world building, right? Like, what mm-hmm. you can see in that book, it's sort of echoes of, like, how we play with world building. And then to McGreeve, where we actually move into another realm for part of the book, right? We
yep.
go to the Ubis realm. Yep. And now here we are, and, like, Cressley's like, now let me show you how vast the universe is. Like,
yes.
And essentially she gives Melanthe this sort of broken power, this, like, fritzy power. And she says, like, well, I can build a portal, but I can't guarantee it's going to be where I think it's going to be. So these portals just keep bringing them into like weirder and weirder and weirder locations. It's Alice in Wonderland.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's everything, right? Well, and it's funny because sometimes, well, let's talk about Pandemonium first, and then I want to talk about Feverus.
Oh, Feverus, yeah. So, okay, so we get to, so I mean, I don't remember the order, but at some point we get to Pandemonia, and Pandemonia is the realm of the demons. We ultimately discover that Pandemonia is hell, like literal, yeah,
literal
hell.
Literal hell.
We're eventually going to meet the king of Pandemonia. Spoiler. In the future. So, and in Pandemonium, there are two factions battling, and they've been battling forever. Like, there is no time when they were not battling.
Yeah.
And they're demon factions. Each one has a portal that links out of hell. Neither one of them has, but they each have a key to the opposite door.
Didn't you just feel like it was some sort of, like, symbol for the patriarchy? Like, I did. I was like, these fucking men just fighting all this fucking bullshit.
I know. Just, well, I mean, especially when Melanthe figures it all out and, like, handles it.
Yeah.
But actually, I had this moment. Do you remember the scene in Labyrinth where she has to choose between two doors and it's like,
one of us always tells the truth and one of us always lies.
And, like, she has to ask the door knockers, like, what door? And then she lands herself in the oubliette with all the weird hands. Like, this is very sort of, like, this is, like, one of those moments in my childhood that, like, has just informed me forever. It's so weird. But I had this, that's where I went. I was, like, it's this kind of wacky, like, world where there are two doors and two keys and, like, the people have the wrong keys. And, like, it's so stupid. It's a stupid, stupid battle that has no end, but it also just, like, has no purpose either. It's so mental. So we're there, and, like, there's this battle, and there are dragons, and it felt very, like, appropriate that the whole world is losing their mind about Game of Thrones this week. And there's just a lot going on, and then they get separated, and Melanthe basically, like, ends a war. Like, she's yeah. just like, I'm gonna go ahead and, like, fix this whole key situation.
Yes, like, so casually, just like.
And what I love is perfect Cressley. I realized in that moment, like, there's this great moment, writers who listen to us, like, it's worth reading this book for no other reason than, like, how Cressley solves this problem, because it's one of those moments where you can imagine that you go around and around and around as a writer at a moment like this. Well, how is she going to get the keys, and is she going to trick them, and where is she going to go, and is yes. she going to go to battle, and she doesn't have skills, like, right. what is her whole thing? And, like, literally the solution is so elegant. Because it's basically, no, she's going to walk right up to the key and take it in both places. And she's queen of persuasion. So she's just going to tell them, like, I'm going to get this key. Right. And it was so magnificent and so simple and dealt with in, like, two paragraphs. And what was amazing is, of course, Thronos has the moment that a writer or a reader would have in this scenario where he's like, how would you do it? And you were in danger. And what's the this and what's the that? And she's like, and she's just like, I just did it. I just handled it. Like, fuck you, patriarchy. Like,
yeah, right?
Never, like, send just, a man to do a woman's job.
Yeah. And that I did feel like there were a lot of really interesting, I'm always really interested in stories where you put people who are competent or used to thinking of themselves as competent in a situation that then, like, challenges everything, and they have to figure out what they're really capable of.
Yeah.
And I felt like that's what Thronos's experience was in Pandemonium, and it really wasn't hers, right?
No.
It was his, and it starts with, like, translating, like, yeah. right, real, like, and a lot of it is because he's getting in touch with the fact that he really is a demon.
Yeah, he doesn't believe he's a demon because he's too elevated for that.
Yes, reckoners are angels, not demons, right?
Can we come back to that piece, the demon piece, like,
yeah,
in a bit? because I do want to like keep, I want to stick with Pandemonium for just a touch longer because there is magnificent moment there right before he finds her, like, you know, sauntering out of wherever with her keys. Right. She, the way that they get separated, like, she's basically like, I'm going to go deal with this. And he's like, no, you're not. And she's, and she persuades him to remain still, like, to basically not move. And she says, you are not going to move
for 24 hours.
For 24 hours. Unless, and he's like, well, what if like a hell beast comes for me? And she's like, all right, fine. If you're in danger, then you can move. And then she leaves and he's there, stuck, frozen. Like, stuck. And she's like, and then he's thinking to himself, and he's, and it's really, it's one amazing. Of these moments where, like, you just think, like, wow, this is such smart, it's such an inspired way of getting around things, right? It's also, it made me think, there are no vows to the lore in this book, but, like, it made me think of, like, how you can get out of a vow to the lore in some way, which we're about to sort of, that's going to be a major piece of the next book. Because he's thinking about her and he's so worried about what might happen to her, like if left, let loose in this like demon killing kingdom.
Yes.
That he's worried about her safety. And he thinks to himself, if she dies and she's my fated mate, I die too. So her being in danger puts me in danger. And instantly he's released.
The thing that's also fascinating about that is it says over and over again that he is just a black and white thinker. Mm-hmm. And yet Pandemonium is where he essentially learns to like think outside the box, like the literal box that he's in.
Yeah. And then what's, but my favorite part of that is like, then he runs to her because he's sure she's going to be in danger. And she's like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
And she's just like handled it. Sliding out with the keys.
Right? I mean, exactly. It's pretty fabulous. And that's like the first, it's the, it's, or I don't know if it's first, but it's one of many moments along the way. The translations, the sort of awareness of how this place that is so the opposite of his place, right, is hot and earthbound and gruesome and
booby-trapped.
Filled with, like, people, like, animals and, like, animals that are
irregularities.
Cool, and, like, demons who want to have sex all the time, like, and war, all these things that, like, the Reckoners don't have because they live in their, like, white sky kingdom with cold showers and clouds, right?
Yes.
Well, no clouds, but whatever. And I just adore every minute of it. And I love, and now maybe we should talk now about what's happening, how they get to Feverus. Because it's not a portal.
No, it's a trick, right? Essentially.
Right. There are all these like tricks.
Yes. I mean, and that's the thing. That was like the part, like the booby trapped part. Like, remember the end, like, you know, so there's so many scenes in Raiders of the Lost Ark where, right, they're trying to like, you know, he's trying to make his way through these places and everything's booby trapped. And the one other part I thought, now here's the part. Thronos, he knows that's his fated mate. It's been 500 years. And we're going to, I think, talk about this with Samantha, but he is still a virgin because once you know who your fated mate is, you can't get with anybody else.
Right. Which is the opposite of what demons are, right? Like, demons attempt women every day forever.
But he has not and he can't. And he is furious with her for, I mean, it's really hard, actually. He basically calls her a slut. Or a slattern, or a whore, or a harlot, a bunch of times, like a lot of times. And she knows that he judges her for, and she's like, I wasn't trying to hurt you, I was living my life. And what happens is there's this one really interesting scene where he essentially like wanders into like a cordoned off kind of, you know, don't go in here territory that is essentially Groundhog's Day. Where he, like, keeps experiencing the same thing over and over again, but he, like, will wake up and know that he can change it. And what he's seeing is Melanthe's death. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that it's so important is because he realizes, like, through this, like, sort of interminable, and it's only him experiencing it, it's not her. She's like, oh my God, he's stuck in there and having seizures and sort of pulls him out. But it's this moment that allows him to realize, like, I've been a fool. Like, I thought something mattered that didn't what matters is our life and our future together, not our past and her like purity. And I think that therefore, like, so every single one of these like experiences in Pandemonium is like teaching him something about himself. And it's, he comes out of hell a lot more likable.
Yeah. Right? Well, because he comes out of hell kind of with an awareness of the fact that he is a demon, that he does have this sort of darker side. And he does that because they are, they get, well, now wait a second. When does he get, when do they, they're still in hell when they go to Feveris.
Yeah, so basically, remember,
they get eaten, right?
They get eaten, but this is the Jonah and the whale part of it, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They think that they've portaled to Feveris. And it's
the
sex
planet.
The sex planet. Hello.
Hey, Robin Lovett. Are you a Cressley Cole fan?
And what's fascinating about this, though, is, and it turns out that really in, they're in the belly of this essentially beast who's like feeding on them. And it's a shared, like illusion, I guess, that they are stuck in. Because then they won't fight to try and get out, right? And what's interesting about it is it's like what they both really secretly want, right? And so for her, it's I get to be with him in this like really hot, sexy way without feeling like I'm going to be judged by him afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, and then for him, it's like I can, you know, the Vreckner laws about premarital sex are so strict and confining that they're not even supposed to kiss anyone.
No.
No contact whatsoever. And he is dying to get with her, right? So it's really interesting that they essentially co-create this like fantasy world that's what both of them want, even though it's for like different reasons.
Yeah. And it's important at this point that we point out that Nyx comes.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, once you sort of figure out, they're in Feveris and, like, and it becomes pretty, like, there's, it's pretty clear pretty quickly that something's up.
Like, yeah, they're both feeling these, like, weird pains and just kind of ignoring it, right?
Yeah, and so, and also we've been told, right, that, like, Feveris, once you've been there for 5 minutes, like she's been there before. Melanthe's been there one time before.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sense, and she was like, and I, you know, tied a rope around my waist and like had them pull me back in.
Yeah.
You know, and I, you know, I was getting naked for a troll, like when they pull me back in, right? And so like Nyx turns up at this like dream Feveris and they're like, oh, we're in Feveris. And she's like, yeah, but are you? Because neither of you want to bone me and look at me. And Melanthe's like, yeah, maybe? I have looked at you before and that is weird because I should want to bone you right now, right? And Nyx is like, I'm not sure you're where you think you are.
Yeah.
And then she like whispers into Thronos's ear, like, this is where, like, you're in this situation. And yeah, then she takes off. And it's interesting because right, it is a moment where like you see Cressley's fingerprints all over it, which uh-huh, is a rare occasion for Cressley.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, but like I think, well, partially what happened was like she had to get them the fuck out of there. Right?
Yeah.
This is
right,
a really hard book to write because Thronos is so like compulsively non-sexual.
Yeah.
That like in order for, and remember you guys, Cressley is coming off of Lothair, McCreeve, and The Professional at this point. So like this is a weird fourth book in that quartet.
I think the other thing that's really interesting about it is, and I'm like trying to figure out how to say this, is I think, and we've, okay, in a series that's this long, right, you have to figure out like what every possible permutation and combination is, right? And it's like, so part of me is like, okay, so, and we've talked a lot about opposites, right? So it's like, if you have a sorcerer who's like loves life, loves sex, loves her powers, loves gold. What is her opposite going to be? Well, this stick in the mud, know-it-all. And that's not a real fun character to write unless you're going to really put him through his paces in terms of, like, making him change. And that change has to be all the ways in which he was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be that he convinces her to, like, start wearing a shroud and give up her powers and be happy up in Sky Hall.
No. So let's talk about Sky Hall because, yeah. I mean, so like I said, I think this is a really hard book. I think it's a tough, I cannot imagine how difficult this book was to write for Cressley because he's so, I mean, like, it's not that sexy. Like, it's right. not, there certainly isn't very much sex in it, period. But also there just isn't much sexiness because every time it sort of crosses into that, Thronos resists it.
Yeah. Right?
There's a constant sense of, like, him having to resist his, like, biological urges.
Yeah.
And in resisting them, he just makes Melanthe feel bad about herself.
Well, and did you feel
that? Or not, maybe, like, she doesn't feel bad about herself, but, like, he's, she feels bad about how
to.
He, yeah, yeah. It's insulting. It's yes. insulting.
And I would say, as a romance reader, I also felt very much like, it was like the voice of everyone who's ever been like, wait, you read what kind of book?
Mm-hmm.
I felt it kind of personally, too, in mm-hmm. a way that I thought was kind of interesting. Maybe, like I said, more so this time around where yeah. I was, like, really ready to fight, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, so then they get up there into the Sky Hall and, like, they're, you know, he's like, I'm going to bed you. Like, we have to go to bed in our big bed. And, like, this particular yep. bed, it felt very Odyssean for me.
Sure.
Like, I was thinking about that bed built.
Bed of Troth is, like, yeah, for, like,
and it's,
betrothal,
they
right?
They start to build it the moment that they're born. Like, it's crazy.
It was also really interesting because several times, though, they talked about how this is something only the more, like, stable groups of immortals could have these, like, I mean, a life of an immortal is very long. Mm. So to have a stable enough home that you could literally build a bed that might be around 500 or 600 years
yeah.
later.
Well, I mean, that's all foreshadowing, right? Because
sure.
Sky Hall is shadowed. It's hidden. It's yes. the only other... There's a lot of reference to the Dacian books. Oh, we should mention that too. So there's a moment in here, and I want to say, so I've only read one of the Shadows books. I've only read one of the Dacian books, and there are two. And
yeah.
what's her name? The god, the sorceress?
Morgana.
Morgana. So Morgana is a big piece of this puzzle. And if you, like I, have not read the book that involves Morgana in the Dacian
Shadows
books, you too probably had a moment where you were like, who the hell is this bitch?
Yeah.
And why is she just, like, riding in here like cavalry? Like, what has happened?
There are two things that are really important in Shadow's Claim. And we made a decision that I stand by, which is we're going to talk about him later. But
Jen made it.
I made the decision and I stand by it because, well, because we couldn't do whatever.
No,
I don't care.
It's
I made
fine.
The decision.
It's fine. I've survived without reading them. So it's fine.
Yeah. It's not just Morgana, but it's also the beheading of the Reckoners, right?
Right.
So when we've met Reckoners earlier in this series, they are monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is terrified of them. And so to then have a Reckoner hero who is convinced of their godliness, right? Their goodness,
right.
their Christian charity.
Right.
It was really fascinating. And in that sense, that's like the thing that you're kind of missing. Because you're like, wait, who the fuck does this dude think he is? I know what they did to Bettina. So
Right.
And so that is kind of interesting.
I mean, the story is told in the context of the book.
Yes.
So
you
don't
have to.
Like, I did not feel like I had to read that book. I had missed out on it. But I did have a moment this time around where I was like, why is this woman just, like, riding in at the 11th hour to, like, battle everything? And I didn't know who she was. Right.
Yeah.
So that is a moment where I wish that I wished that I had read those Dacian books. However, or that one Dacian book. However, yeah. There is... Shit, I forgot what I was going to say.
But don't you feel like, must have been a lie? Should I tell that story to everybody? You guys, I was telling Sarah, my beloved grandmother, we were talking about, like, things your grandparents said to you, right? And my grandma, if you would, like... be talking and forget what you were going to say, she would say, must have been a lie. But she'd do it with this, like,
God, I love it.
Twinkle in her eye. And it was honestly the most amazing thing.
I
love it. Thing.
I told Jen I wanted to put it in a book. So now if I do, you'll all know what that means.
Yeah, for sure. Here's the thing, though. Don't you feel like that's what Nyx is doing? I mean, in a, like, it's literally God
coming in
the
at
machine,
the 11th hour.
Right? Coming in at the 11th hour.
Okay, yeah, sure. Except... Nyx has been doing it for 17 books.
Sure.
So I care less about it when Nyx comes. Like, when Nyx comes in, I'm like, oh, here comes Nyx to fix everything. Or to make everything more complicated.
Right.
So this is all fine. But my issue is, so they get up to Sky Hall. And they are living, and he's basically like, it's time.
Yeah.
We're going to get this done. Like, I'm ready. I've been wanting to have sex with you for a long time.
Yeah.
At this point, like, he's figured out that his horns are sexual organs.
Yes.
He is feeling, he knows there's a seal. He knows the seal is going to break. He is ready. And he's like, but hang on a sec, because I got to go and get a thing.
Yes.
And then he runs out. He leaves her in their, like, house, their roofless house.
Yep.
I'd also want to say these houses have no roofs. And she's like, so do people just fly over and look? And he's like, no.
No.
Like, and of course, like, if you lived in this place, you'd definitely be flying over your neighbor's houses.
Sure, of course. Hello.
So anyway, and he goes and he gets a sheet with a hole in it.
Oh, my God.
Ugh, this fucking guy.
But you know what? This is his culture.
I mean, at the same time, though, this is where we start to see, like, okay, full... There's no... Crest is not even trying to hide, like, what she's pointing to here.
No, not at all. I mean, come on. They've been to heaven. They've been in the belly of the beast. Now they're in heaven. I mean, it's so biblical that there's, like, no way to miss any of it. And
yeah, the, like, Christian allegory here.
Yeah. What I thought was... And I think Samantha wanted to talk about this, but I think it's fine, is I was really interested, though, in her, like, being like, this is important to him, so I'm going to do it.
I know. It was so kind, and I totally wouldn't have done that myself.
No. I would have been like, get that fucking holy sheet off of me. Like, we're fucking or we're not. Like, right? But I do think that in a romance, right, like, we talk a lot about, like, what it means to be partners and to have a partnership. Yeah. And I think she's like, boy, it's this weird thing, right, where you're like, she shouldn't have to give up anything.
Mm-hmm.
But then...
No, I mean, because here's the truth of it. She really loved each other. Like, one of the most magnificent moments in this book, and it happens a few times, is when he, like, wraps her in his wings.
In his wings.
Right? Like, wraps her in his, like, massive wings to protect her from fire, to protect her from cold, to protect her from animals. Like, every time he does it, every time they close each other, he closes her into his wings. Like, one of them says, when we were children, we used to tell secrets this way.
Yeah.
Like there's this, like, moment where you realize, like, he was always a secret from, like, she kept him a secret as when they were children from her family, and he's kind of keeping her a secret now from his, like, from all of the outside influences. And his wings, his, like, demon, the demon in him is doing that. And it's really, really beautiful.
It's another thing about this I was thinking, and I, you know, I don't love stories where, like, fated mates meet as children. I find it, like, a little creepy, but I think...
I'm writing one of those right now, man.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I don't know, like, even teenagers, right? But I'm like, nine? She was nine?
Yeah.
He was 11. I don't know. Whatever. Anyway, it's fine.
Well, they weren't, my favorite. Like, doing it.
I know. It doesn't matter. But I feel like the thing about that, though, is, like, okay. It's like fate versus free will, right? Like, this attention. Like, how am I going to say this? Okay. I love the idea of fated mates because it puts people in conflict with each other, right? At their, like, really, like, core selves. Who are we and can we, like, make this work together? But when you're putting, like, children in that situation, it's also this, like, really interesting thing where you're like, but they don't even know who they are.
Right. They have to relearn each other. Spoiler, that's the whole arc of the book that I'm writing right now. And it's because, like, that's the only way it can work is, like, yes. You cannot be the people you were when you were children, yes, because you would then be adult children.
Yes. Well, here's the other thing, though. I don't think in this book that she would be able to forgive him if they would not have been best friends as children. Right? Like all the terrible things that he does when he, like, finds her again and he keeps calling her a whore and all this stuff. Like, I think she would have been, like, literally fuck right off.
Yeah.
But the basis of this, like, they were best friends. And that means that, like, this is a rough patch rather than being the way they start.
And also, again, we've talked about this before, but it's really balanced because there's a balance to this book that comes from him having, like, her having done what she did to him. Like, it is a truly awful experience. Like, he sees instantly in that moment when they're children, he's trying to understand, right? Again, it's this black and white thinking, right?
Yeah.
He's in that moment in her home, and he senses that something has gone terribly wrong. And he's just basically like, wait a second. Like, just give me 1 second to think through what's just happened here. And you sort of have, there's this great moment where you sort of have this feeling that, like, he's going to see it. He'll get there. If you just give him 5 minutes, he'll get there. And Melanthe's so broken. She's so hurt. She's so tortured by what's happened to her family that she refuses to give him that.
Yeah. Well, and that's the part, though, I also, one of the most inexplicable moments in this book for me is, and it's probably in the first third where, like, they're just starting to talk to each other, right? Like, they're so full of mistrust that they can't. And there's this moment where she finally, like, she talks about, like, what was done to me and what was done to my sister and my parents. And there's a moment where he thinks something like, he'd never really considered that she had, like, something to be really upset about. And I was like, dude, her parents were fucking beheaded by your father.
Yeah.
Like, what do you mean? Like, I, and that was the part I.
But it's growth, right? It's.
Yeah.
It goes back to what you were saying. Like, they're children. They mm-hmm. can't be trusted, right? They can't be trusted to know what love is. They can't be trusted to, like, whatever fantasy that they have about what happened when they were 11 or 12 is a fantasy. The truth is never what a child thinks it is at that age, right?
Right, right.
Because it just can't be. And so as, like, this is, I mean, I'll say it again, it's just Thronos' story. Like, it's all Thronos having to learn how to be a person.
One reason I don't love, like, I don't really tend to enjoy, like, second chance at love plots is because I often feel like one of the characters really has been in stasis. And it's almost always the heroine.
Mm.
And part of the, right? Like, so she's been, like, sad and kind of stuck and he's moved on and had a life and then they get back together. And I'm always like, you know what? These books really only work for me if everybody's moved on and they're literally different people because of the lives they've had. And now when they're going to try again, it's going to work because they're different, right? But it's really interesting to me that in this book, he's the one who's been stuck. And she's the one who's gone on to live a life. And I think that that's also, though, because he knows it's his fated mate, that he doesn't feel like he even knows how to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, he talks a lot in the beginning about how she's taken away the things that were, like, promised to him. Like, she owed him something.
Yeah, like, she owed him a wife, she owed him children, yes. She owed him a family, she owed him love. Like, and she's kind of like, fuck off. And I mean, I love that. I want to say, and then I think we should get to Samantha. I just want to point out that this is the first time someone actually gets pregnant on the page.
Yep.
In IED. Holly has had twins. And right. Like, maybe Holly's pregnant at the end, but she's not, like, it's not part of the story that Holly gets pregnant.
It's like, you're definitely probably pregnant, Holly, because there's no way that wasn't going to happen. But
yeah, because you're the fucking vessel. So get over it. But Melanthe is in heat. I mean, like, basically, I guess, like, sorceress,
smell it on her.
Sorceresses get, they are in heat. It's weird. But fine. Cool. No kink shaming. And he can smell it on her. And he's basically like, now, if we do this now, we're going to get pregnant. And she's like, cool.
One of the, like, small moments in this book, and a way, and I found myself really, again, with, like, the recent abortion laws being passed, is her mother, Elizabeth, is seen as she's kind of crazy. She's sort of, but, like, imagine what it would be like to essentially have given birth to Omort.
Yeah.
To the Accession's greatest warrior for evil. And you were the vessel for that. And in Holly's case, we know that they're after her, but, like, it's going to end up being, like, a happy story.
Well, it has to be, right? Because it's a romance. So we don't worry about Holly.
Yeah, no, of course not. But I found myself really thinking, like, well, shit, you be as crazy as you want. You deserve it, right?
And I mean, and Melanthe feels that way, too. Like, she's sort of like, I think she has sort of come to this place where she understands her mother in a different way. And it's really, I noticed that too. And I mean, it had to have had something to do with what was going on in the world this week, but it felt very much to me like Cressley was making a point, which was, and I mean, there is something to the fact that, like, they don't have sex until 3/4 of the way through the book. And part of the reason why they don't have sex until 3/4 of the way through the book is because she's going to get pregnant, in the sense, and I don't mean that on the page. I mean, yeah. I mean, I think Cressley is giving them time to, like, she sets it out as if they have sex, she's going to get pregnant. So, and then ultimately he does kind of say to her, like, you know that if we do this, this will happen. And he leaves her the space to say, yes, yeah. I want this. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know why I'm saying all this, because I don't have a theory on why this character is the character who gets pregnant. And I don't know that I love that it's this book.
Yeah.
But it happens.
Here's my answer to that is, Melanthe has been in charge of her own sexuality and her own body this entire story, her entire life. And so if there was going to be a character who was like, I'm ready to get pregnant, it would be her, because she knows who she is and she, like, right? As opposed to, like, with Holly, it really kind of wasn't a choice. And I think you're going to maybe put that decision in the hands of your most, like, rock solid, yes, I own all of my sexual choices kind of character.
Yeah.
And I think that's, in an interesting way, like, the one thing maybe we could talk about before we switch over to talking about Samantha is, like, the fact then that his memory is stolen from him, right? Yeah. And I found that to be a really, like, a terrible, terrible curse that she puts upon him.
And about upon both of them.
Yes. Yes.
But it had to happen. And is why, like, I didn't feel, I mean, we've talked about this with a lot of books. So, like, did he grovel enough? Was he punished enough? And I know that we've gone around and around. But, like, for me, this book, he did not. Like, she was stolen from him and he had no choice. Like, he just lived in this, like, empty believe, like, he finally, it's like she was removed from his memory and suddenly he was able to see how bleak it was, that world. Like, how it lacked all
color, vibrancy. All life, all vibrancy, yeah. And that's what Sky Hall was, right? That's what it was, like, intending to do. And he's like, yo, no, this is great. But when he actually experiences that as a life,
yeah,
it's awful.
Yeah. She's always been color to him. Like, he sees her in a field. The first time he sees her in a verdant field, like, surrounded by berries. Like, and, like, she's color. And he's, and then when she's gone, all he knows is that he's lost this. And then that brings us back to Pandemonium, right? Because he goes back to Pandemonium because he takes the long way. That's what it's called, the long way. And, like, they meet before they start on that path, but they meet and then they go down this long way to this, like, verdant, beautiful, like, oasis in the middle of this, like, hellscape. And it's magnificent. And it makes sense for them because they really have been on a journey together.
And that she then, the things that, like, broke her powers, like trying to heal her sister, but she heals him, right? And that, like, telling him to remember. I mean, I found that, like, the sense of it, like, coming together, like, yeah, the beginning of, like, the story closing.
It's very
that way.
Beautifully written. It's a really, like, tightly written book. It's also short. It's a very short IAD book, but it's very, in a way that none of the other, and this is, again, it feels different because it doesn't feel like any of the other books, in that there is a very clean, lovely, kind of private arc to it.
I would agree. Okay, I want us, when we switch over to talking to Samantha, you know what we didn't talk about, but I want to, is Fury.
Oh, yeah.
And Marius and his monk-like elephant dong. I don't even know.
Woo. I know. Well, let's talk about that because that's one of the few places where there's actual, like, reference to sex in the book. So, all right. Well, welcome, Samantha. We are so excited to have you.
Why don't you tell us about yourself?
Hi, I'm Samantha. I also go by SS Jackson if you follow me on Twitter. I'm the one who did the vagina thread not too long ago. I think you guys mentioned it in one episode, right?
We did.
we did? What was the vagina thread? I don't remember anything. Once it's happened on the show, it's gone from my head.
Yeah, I did a whole vagina. I think that tweet was my second most liked tweet. The first one is still the one about the Immortals After Dark.
Tell this. Initiation. I love it. Was a plane, right? Like, you were on a plane? Tell the story.
Yeah, it was after RWA last year in Denver. And I forget sometimes when I'm wearing makeup, and I'll rub my eyes and get, like, the raccoon look. And this guy was being super creepy on a Southwest flight when I was flying back from Seattle to Denver. And he sat in the middle seat, and, like, I was one of the first people to get on the plane. And he started talking me up, and he's like, well, what happened to your eye? And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you have a black eye. And I realized immediately what I did. But I was just, like, tired and snarky. And I was like, oh, you know, club initiation. And he was like, oh, yeah, what club? And I was reading Immortals After Dark. And so I was like, Immortals After Dark. And he got up and moved. He was like, what in the hell? And that was probably, I think that's still my most liked tweet to this day.
Well, and also you've now given that to the whole group. Anytime some weirdo comes up to you anywhere and asks you weird questions.
Yeah.
Just tell them you're a member of the Immortals After Dark Club.
Right. We could get, like, leather jackets, like the pink ladies in Greece.
Sure. There you go. the Valkyrie ladies.
Wait, but what was the vagina tweet?
Oh, I did a whole thread on, like, vagina rage because I've had a lot of vagina issues. I was just mad one day.
Well, it was like education, right? Like, you were talking about all the things you learned that you never learned when you were, like a teenager.
Oh, right. My God. Yeah, I somehow missed this whole thread, and now I have to go back and find it. It'll be in show notes, everyone.
It's brilliant. Well,
basically how, like, sex, I remember, like, being 14 and, you know, reading romance novels and being like, dude, they're both enjoying this, and that is not how it is in the real world. And that's when I kind of started to realize, like, sex is definitely for the man in the real world, but in Romancelandia, it's for us.
Yeah. Fair.
Well, that seems like an appropriate beginning to a discussion of Dark Sky.
Well done. That was a really nice segue. So let's talk about... So it's funny because when I do remember, like, it's like a week in between, like, the recordings of these. But, you know, we talked a lot about Thronos, but not as much about Melanthe. And one of the reasons why is because I knew, Samantha, that you really wanted to talk about her as, like, a heroine who really is in charge of her own, like, sexual history and her own sexual pleasure. So, like, why does that speak to you? Because, like, this was a book that, like, not as many people love, but I know that you have a real fondness for.
I mean, if I'm being honest, I have a real fondness for most of the books.
Well, sure.
Naomi and what's his face? I don't remember.
Shh. Well, you're wrong about that.
I was like, I've been re-listening to that one because I love it so much.
Oh, it's so good.
I just imagine her, like, twitting around, and it bothers me.
Dark, dark, dark dancing at dusk. Dark dancing at a silver moon. What's it called? Maybe.
Dark needs at night's edge? No, that's another
correct.
One.
That's correct. The edge. I always, the edge is the edge of the property line for me in my head. That's how I try to remember. Oh. Like, that's how I can recognize.
There you go.
Whose book the title is, but I can't do it in reverse.
Anyway. So both male virgin books start with dark in the title.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, there are others, though. Dark Desires After Dusk. Who's that? I mean,
trying to find, like, the secret calculus of these names would really be something.
It's so weird. So, it's so weird.
So, trigger warning. Rape, miscarriage, all that stuff. And I touched on this in my vagina thread, but my past with sex, as it is for a lot of women, or essentially people who aren't cis hetero males, is very, you know, complicated. It's got a lot of layers. I'm a rape survivor. I've had a miscarriage. I was in a abusive relationship for 6 years, and I came back to myself through romance and finding series that kind of gave me back some power in knowing that it's okay to enjoy sex again. Sorry, my voice is cracking because I can talk about stuff. I'm totally okay, but it's still not that easy.
Of course, it's your story. I mean, it's really powerful. And to know that romance does that for people is part of the reason I love it so much.
Yeah, yes. I don't think you're alone at all in this.
I'm not.
Which I hope gives you a sense of community.
Oh, I'm not. And I mean, Romancelandia has totally been one of my, like, greatest healing, like, aspects of the whole process. Like, my therapist, I swear she knows about as much going on in Romancelandia as I do. but Lanthe just really speaks to me because throughout the entire book, she does not apologize once for her sexual past.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Not once. I even had a quote written down that I can't find because I have a lot of notes right now. But basically, he says, like, why would you want to sleep with him? And she says, why not?
Yeah.
Like, she never apologized, and she never wavers. And I feel like in a lot of books, you know, heroines are really proud of their sexual past until it's that time to finally have that last reconciliation. And then for some reason, there's some sort of apology about it, if that makes sense. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to give any examples because I don't want to put anyone on blast.
Sure.
But they're just like, and she does not waver once, and she never lets anyone, I mean, she's constantly taken advantage by males who want her powers or something else from her. And she never once blames herself for that. She always says, like, that was them.
Yeah.
They wanted something from me. They used me. And she never, ever once blames herself. And that mm-hmm. is something that women are trained to do the opposite of.
Yeah.
From day one of having a sexual identity.
I read a book. I just read a book where a hero is a, it's not Immortals After Dark, but it felt, it was just like a moment. I had a moment where the hero, his wife has died. It's been 2 years. And he sort of matter-of-factly says that like about a month or two after she died, he basically went out like once a week and just had like a one night stand. And I was like, okay, for sure. Fine. That's like 100 women. And I didn't really care, except that I noted that a woman would never be given that story, and it would never be given so matter-of-factly.
Sure.
That, right. Right? Ever. And I liked that the heroine didn't judge him, but I was kind of like, the reverse would never happen, right?
Yeah. Well, this whole book is sort of flipping the script on how we think about, like, wallflower rake. Like, he definitely has a stick up his ass, just like a lot of, like, proper wallflower heroines in the early...
It's a whole tree.
Yeah.
In the early days of the genre. And now, and she really is like a really like lovely rake in the sense that she has been around the block and no one seems like it's not a thing except to him.
And Cressley totally calls it out in that one scene with Nereus, who I told Jen has he has like big ew energy because I just can't stand him. But he does have one good point, and it's when he says, why is sex the one thing men want their women to be novices at?
Yes.
Yeah. And she's like, exactly, thank you. And I was like, okay, you get a half point, Nereus, but I still hate you, like you're gross.
Yeah, he's super gross, but I kind of want to like hang with him.
Does oh yeah gross?
on the bed of what are those, like when she's like laying on the bed and she's on top of like creatures. Oh
well, and like the description of his like donkey cock, right, that is like basically hanging down to the ground or something, was a whole lot. Like, did I miss that? I mean, I like read it and was like, wait, really?
It's not hot imagery.
No, at all.
Nereus is like life of the party guy. Like, if you get invited to like the party at Nereus's house, you go
and you prepare for a big flopping schlong.
You don't go for him. You go for the experience of watching.
Yeah, he probably has some really intense orgies.
Well, and you make sure that no one can, like, get anything in your drink, right? Because, like, who knows what would happen.
Yeah, you drink bottled water only.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, though, is that I had forgotten that they actually see Fury. And one of the things that I had... Like, as we went back and reread, like, the beginning of the series, I remember thinking, like, this is so weird. Like, all these stories are still really good, but, like, now that we're in the, like, you know, movement 3, or we're going to get to movement 3, which is, like, the Morior, it felt like so many of those plot lines is sort of, like, were, like, essentially dead ends. But it's really interesting to see how she is really actually, like, literally resurrecting them.
I think this is really interesting because we talked a little bit in our conversation about Lanthi's kind of freedom and her resilience and her unwillingness to compromise on this sort of really ridiculous problem that Thronos has about this is a real Thronos problem and not a Melanthi problem.
Right. And so it's also like a real life problem.
It's a real life problem too. But what I think is really interesting here is that the actual sex on the page in this book really tackles this problem or this issue from all sides, right? Because he is so in his head about what sex should be there for and should mean and how it should go. And she is having none of it. And I think that... is a really powerful, it's a powerful act, and it's a powerful sort of subversion of patriarchy and the way that we think about women and sex. And I just think it's really I'm very grateful that you brought this up because I feel like it is so important and it feels like even more important now in 2019.
I think her persuasion is such a powerful theme in this book because, I mean, if you want to talk about Bible references, the Bible, you know, if you want to go with the evangelical definition or viewing of it, women are evil. The tongues of women will convince men to do evil and sinful things, right? That's why we have periods and stuff because Eve ate the apple, because we are constantly tempting men to do wrong. And so Lanthi having the power of persuasion where she can literally force anyone to do what she wants just by speaking, not even on purpose, you know, most of the time, at least when she's younger, is a very scary thing. And just watching it and the parallel of his acceptance of her and his believing her and her truth, despite knowing she has this power, I think is like a really powerful progression in terms of, you know, you want to talk about relating to today, men believing women, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, because he, with her, his brother and stuff and how they always attacked her, he starts saying like, no, no, they'd never do that. And the more she speaks her truth without persuasion, the more he says, why would she say this to me? You know, if it's not true.
Well, it's interesting then, too, that her tongue was cut out, right? Like, but yes. Yet she still is true, right? Like, that whole, like, symbol then, like, kind of fails for him because, you know, if this is, like, your tongues are literally, like, the source of this evil, and yet her tongue is gone, and yet what the story she's telling is still there. Like, it's, and the fact that then they communicate telepathically, like, there's some way that they're really connected that I just thought that was, like, really powerful. And we talk a lot about Lothair's heart being ripped out as being, like, really symbolic, but it's no mistake that it's, like, her tongue, right?
Right. Right, no. Like her voice is literally taken from her. Yeah, and well, I think the other thing that's funny too is if you think about it, Lanthi never uses her persuasion to lie. Morgana uses it to lie to Thronos and make him forget her, but she never uses it to lie. She uses it to get herself out of safety when she tells the other sorcerer to sleep, but I don't think she ever uses it to lie. She just uses it to get herself to safety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and to get all the Reckoners to safety at the end, right? Like, she's the one who, like, pushes the alarm.
Right, right. Which I think, you know, speaks to how this book, I think this book is just such a, like, constant symbol of women in power, too. Because, I mean, if you look, like, even when she shows up in court as Thronos' wife for the first time, I can't remember his name, but it's the knight who we don't like. We'll call him Fuckboy Knight. But he says, like, she still has her power. Like, she's going to persuade us all to, like, do that, right?
Yeah.
And it is just, like, you know, she walks in there and she notes how there's no female knights. You know, all the sorcerer lose their souls because they can't be trusted. And it's this total, like, reverse universe compared to the rest of the Immortals After Dark world, because in the Immortals After Dark world, like, women are powerful and women are strong, and that's to be respected. And this is the one place where the patriarchy's in place.
Although it did mm-hmm. remind me a lot of Sabine's, like, sort of saving the women on, like, that demon plane. Did we talk about the sheet, Sarah, last week?
Very, very vaguely, because we knew that Samantha wanted to talk about the sheet.
I mean, who knew a sheet could be so sexy?
Well, what we did talk about, Samantha, so you should know, is that we talked about the fact that, like, he gets her finally to this bed, this, like, bed that's been built for him, like, was built for him when he was born. And he's like, okay, finally, we get to do it. And once we do it in this bed, we're married and this is done. Like, we're mated forever. And then he's like, oh, hang on a second. I gotta go get a thing. And then, like, he runs to the church and, like, gets this, like, holy sheet, literally and figuratively, and then brings it back to her. And she doesn't flinch. She's like, okay, I guess we're doing it with this sheet right now.
Yeah, I think she says, like, kinky.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, even there, she claims, like, she claims her spot in the bed because they do it once his way and he claims her. And then she, I still can't figure out how she switches the sheet because in my mind at this point, it looks like, you know, the Charlie Brown ghost sheet where there's just like two holes cut out.
No, because you know what? It's supposed to like lay over her entirely. But it's
yeah,
like,
I think there's just one hole.
There's just the one hole. But what happens is like they've pushed it down to her waist. So essentially it's like kind of laying over, I think, her bottom half. And then when she essentially like rolls him over and is now on top of him, it just like flutters down over him, right? And now she's the one on top of this hole in the sheet.
And his penis is just like
right out the right.
top. A glory hole.
Like, it's so sexy, but I'm also over here like, how does this not get caught in his wings? Like, how are they not tangled?
Oh, in his wings.
Yeah.
Right?
I forgot about the wings.
Ugh. Like, I'm just like, I feel like
it's
someone
would
get stuck.
It's because of God, Samantha.
Okay.
The podcast is now over, everyone. Oh, shit.
God made the fucking good. That's what happened on the
V8. I feel like he could never be on his back with those wings. All right, anyway.
Oh, nobody always is because that's how, because then he wraps them around her, which is the sexiest part.
Oh, it is.
I have to say, I do not find the sheet sexy in any way. Like, I'm like, whatever, just get this sheet business over with. I just want them to do it inside his wings all the time. Like, why can't his wings be the sheet and then both be inside them? No kink shaming, Samantha, if you're into the sheet.
It was more just like interesting. If I don't think about it too hard, I think it's the whole like, you know, barely show. I imagine it being a very translucent sheet.
Oh, no. I think it was
I don't
like,
think this is at all translucent.
They didn't want you seeing. This was like, you know, very puritanical, like literally.
Yeah, this is like sailcloth.
That's so sexy.
You know what? I know, I'm like, we ruined it. You know what? Here's what was interesting to me about that scene is when he like brings it out, I kind of wanted her to fight. I wanted her to be like, that's fucking ridiculous and we're not going to do it this way. Because of like the patriarchy. And instead she's kind of like, okay, sure. And she makes it sexy, right, for both of them. And then when she flips over, it's her saying like, okay, I respect your culture in the same way I want you to respect mine. Right?
And I'm going to persuade you to have orgasm denial.
So in that way, I thought it was important. Like if she was like, I'm going to wear my mini skirts and I'm going to wear my gauntlets and I'm going to wear my, you know, sorcery gear, then I'm going to give you some of that back. Right.
Yeah. No, she did. She owned the night or day.
I mean, I do think that there is another piece here, which is like this book does have to have sort of mutual acceptance in it. And the reality is that like as much as he hates Sorcerai, she hates the Reckoners.
Yeah.
So like everything that she stands for, or actually I would argue that's not actually true because Thronos doesn't hate the Sorcerai. Like from the moment he meets her, he's like, Sorcerai are complex. Like what we're doing to them, like in his mind, he's like, there's something more to them versus like all she's experienced at the hands of Reckoners is pain. So when she throws him out the window and he falls down into the crevasse and like breaks himself, like she's hurting him. And so in this moment, part of this sheet moment is her having to accept his identity in order to heal both of them, in order to heal their relationship.
Yeah. Well, but I also think it's really interesting. Like, she broke him, right? And then he was perfectly cured. And then it was, like, his determination to find her. Like, he basically fucks himself. He fucks himself up, right? And I thought that that was, like, a really interesting metaphor for how sometimes our obsessions are like our downfalls, right? Like the things that we feel that we are owed, the things that we think have been stolen from us or taken from us, when we cling to the ways that we perceive the world has treated us unfairly, those are the things that make us bitter and twisted, not the things really other people do to us. I mean, maybe that's going too far, but I don't know.
I mean, isn't that the whole story of Icarus? And that might be the wrong character.
Oh, you're right. He gets right. wings and
flies too close that's to the sun.
That's really interesting.
You're totally right.
Look at you, smarty pants.
Mm. I took Greek mythology. That's Greek mythology, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I was like, I did that maybe.
Well, and like in this case, it's his brother has sort of steered him wrong, right? He doesn't know what his brother's been up to. And Icarus, it's his father, right? Daedalus is the... is the, like, inventor, and they're going to escape or whatever. And his son kind of gets away from him and flies too close and melts it all off, and he, you know, plummets into the sea. But I do think it's, like, a really interesting point, too, about how, like, blind trust in people in our family when we don't really know what's going on with them maybe doesn't lead to the greatest things ever happening.
Well, blind trust in family yeah. and blind trust in faith, especially when the two are so intertwined.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. I mean, it's a really different we talked about this on our in the podcast already, but it is a really different book than all the other books in the series. It feels different. It has a different voice almost. Like, it has a different structure. It's
yeah.
Cressley's doing something very clear here. And also, I mean, like, there's something really fascinating about the clear religious messaging here. And we are about to, in the next IAD book, meet the primordial demon. You know, and he won't have his book for two books, but like when we meet the Morior, we are literally going to meet the king of hell.
God, he's sexy.
From which these demons were
like spawned, right?
Came. Yeah. Like, they came from him. So, and we know this for a fact because when Thronos goes back to Pandemonia, he can read all the demonish signs, which are, and like that is Sion's entire, that's his entire realm.
Yeah.
So, interesting, what Cressley's doing is almost starting to give us, like, I don't know, we're starting to see hints at the accession sort of blown out into a much larger conversation about good and evil.
Well, and I thought it was really interesting in this, at the end, it's like Nyx and Morgana, is that her name? Mm-hmm. And like Nyx turns to her and is like, and so it begins, right? And it's interesting too, because in the Bible, of course, it's like ends with like the apocalypse, right? And like this second coming, and then we literally have the coming of the Morior. So in some ways it makes sense to me that this book feels like meditative, like a prayer almost, because something is coming.
Well, and when that thing comes, everything
yes.
changes.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it doesn't matter how many bricks Nyx has laid, they're ultimately Orion will come, and I mean, I hope he will also come, but
right?
But ultimately Orion will come, and he with him, like, they are the bringers of doom.
Yeah,
right. But doom for who, or for whom? Doom for whom?
I would really hate to be immortal right now, like an actual yeah. human. I'd be like, fuck.
Yeah.
Well, you have. Yeah, and you have to assume at this point that he's coming for, ultimately, they come for the Provis. But Nyx doesn't know that. She can't see it.
And that's what's getting interesting, too, because this is the book where she makes her play, you know, to be a goddess, right? Like, things are, like, yeah. leveling up for her, and she's been the one who's been pulling the strings on all these people all along, explicitly too at the beginning of this book, right? Thronos, be in this place at this time so you can get captured, and that's how you're going to get Melanthe back, right? Presumably this is something Nyx could have told him any old time she wanted to in the past 5 centuries. So that's the part that's always been unclear to us, because we never knew her, you know, her end game,
right? Yeah, we didn't
right?
know she was planning to be a goddess.
Right.
Well, and speaking of, I mean, do you guys want me to go conspiracy theory on this?
Sure.
Please.
Before we do the okay. locked limb count, give it to us.
Yes. Well, because So Jen knows I have a murder wall because I've been like mapping out everything because I'm a nerd.
Yeah. Is this the episode where we're going to reveal the photographs of this murder wall?
Yeah, we need pictures.
Well, so one of the themes I know, so, you know, we talk about how could Nyx get her love story. And she mentions in this book that she will die and rise from the ashes. And when I listened to that, I totally missed it in my like first couple reads, I guess. But I thought about it, and there is literally in every book some form of death and then of a, you know, of a rising in the coupleship, whether it's, you know, like Conrad literally goes nuts, you know, and then he's brought from his mental state from by Naomi. And then what's the last guy? McGreeve, you know, he lost his, oh my God, I can't think of the word right now.
His mind, his everything. Yeah, yeah. You're right. Sure, well, he lost his like.
And he, you know, there's a theme in every single book where a hero or a heroine, you know, has like some part of them has died and they rise from the ashes because of their fated mate. And that hasn't happened with, from what we know from couples in the past. Usually just like, hey, you know, my paranormal senses are going ding, ding, ding. Let's do this. But like, there's a lot of work for this. And I mean, Fury, she's going to have to, I don't know how the hell she's going to come back from whatever she's doing.
She's going to need a lot of therapy and like a lot of,
well, as we know, that's always the angle that Cressley comes at is like therapy.
I'm fucking therapy.
I mean, it's interesting because I remember like way back in the first episode we talked about Nyx and I said like, oh, well, she's the primordial Valkyrie or rather Fury is the primordial Valkyrie. We're talking about Fury. And then somebody online corrected me and said, Fury's not a Valkyrie. She's a Fury. So, I mean, like arguably Nyx is the primordial Valkyrie, which means there's a seat at the Morior table for her.
Yeah.
Right. Wasn't Fury one of the three when they caught Lothair when he was a kid?
I think so.
Wait, I'm sorry. Wasn't Fury the what?
Remember, Lothair first meets Nyx. He's walking somewhere and he like gets caught by Nyx and two of her sisters. And I think Fury is one of them and Emma's mom is the other one.
Yeah, I don't fully understand Fury. I'm told by listeners, hi listeners, that she's a Fury and not a Valkyrie, but I don't quite understand like why those two things are different. But I believe you.
I just think she's, I mean, I think it's like, it'll just, you know, it's sad because this actually was supposed to be Monroe Day. And I feel like I was like, we would have had all these interesting other pieces, parts, right, to put together. But I'm fascinated to see how it all turns out because I do think that the reason this book is really different is not just because it's ending Act Two, right? It's putting Torture Island to bed, right? And literally, it's also putting like sky islands to bed. Like a lot of things come crashing down. And so it's of course going to be the thing that opens up movement three. But, you know, I can't wait to see what's next.
It's interesting because this sort of movement three question is thrown into a little bit of chaos for us in our minds by virtue of the fact that the Monroe book is not a Morior book, right? She has four other Morior sitting at the table now, if you count the dragon, which I do. you know, I don't think he gets a book, but like, my God, I wish that he would. And instead of going forward, she's still like tying up loose ends from the past. So, I'm desperate for Monroe for many, many, many reasons, not the least of which is like, how does it play into
right where we are right now?
Movement three. Yeah. So, I mean, it should, before we do Lost Limbs, we should just say to everybody who's listening, because we didn't say this when we recorded, Jen, just the two of us, like, Monroe is not coming, not right now, at least. We've been told sometime later in the year, Cressley put out a newsletter. You should all go to Cressley's website and sign up for her newsletter, and then you can get that information along with us, or you should follow us on all forms of social media, and we will let you know when we have news.
But if you share, make sure you read it all the way, because Sarah got mad at me one time because she mentioned you guys, and I shared it, but she also put one of your books as like a must read. And I didn't get that far before I shared.
It's okay. It's okay.
I got mad at you.
Well, not really. You were like, way to drop the ball, Samantha. And I was like, well, I'm sorry. I got so excited.
I think at that time, I was not a subscriber to the Cressley Cole newsletter. And then when somebody emailed me and was like, Cressley recommended one of your books, I was like, what?
Yeah, I did.
And now here we are.
Because she mentioned the podcast. And I got too excited.
Oh, my God. She mentioned the podcast. I was like, I need to retire to be in her book's fainting couch for a while so I can just like, woo.
So, okay, fine. Lost Limbs, you guys. This is, we need to get going. But, all right, well, I'm going to start because I actually think that we need to include Thronos' foot from Kiss of a Demon.
And I think it was actually on there. Like, I'm going to go back and look, but I'm pretty sure it might already be there. So, yeah, because we knew he was coming.
And obviously, I know that he doesn't technically lose anything, but we have to include the, like, leap from the window and all the broken bits.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, and then later on in that sort of looping where she's like going to get crushed by a boulder, right?
And God, he loses so many.
Yeah. And but his willingness to harm himself to save her. So I guess we're just going to count it once, even though no actual limbs were lost, but the soul was ready to lose those limbs. What was he losing? His feet?
His legs.
He like ripped
his
off
arm at one point. I mean, Lachlan, he makes him look like nothing. Like Lachlan chewed off his arm. Nice job.
I'm like amateur, Thronos, exactly.
Yeah, Thronos does it over and over again. And then the more it happens, he's like, okay, cut off leg. Like it becomes like a to-do list. Yeah.
Melanthe's tongue. Yep.
Tongue, yeah. Felix, his head. Felix is the sorcerer.
Yeah.
He's like kind of creepy. And Thronos is walking towards her. That scene kills me. And he's just like, boop, you're done.
There's a couple times where Thronos, I would argue, does some beheading as a romantic gesture.
yes.
Right? Because she's impressed by it. She's in danger. And the fact that he can like behead and fight these demons is something that, you know, she's like, that's my man. So I think that we should definitely count those.
Yeah, he does a lot of throat slicing with the claw on the top of his wing.
I know, it sounds like a lot. Ooh.
It's very aggressive. Do we count the carnage at the beginning of the book when they're escaping Torture Island?
No, because it's too complicated. It's like a orgy of violence.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot happening.
That's so true. But yeah, I think that was it. That's what I had.
I did have one question, though. Do you guys have any theories as to what escaped with them from the beast belly?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question. We did not discuss
which
this.
Was very Jonah and the whale, right? Another biblical story, right? The Bible is full of great stories.
I mean, my theory, as you know, Samantha, as somebody who listens to the podcast, is that often Cressley puts things on the page just for, like, future use. Like, at some point, she may need
a monster to appear
that's escaped from the beast belly. I will say this. I have another piece of information that I have gleaned from somebody else in my life who knows a little more about Cressley's process. And apparently, Cressley also has a murder wall. That is confirmed.
Mm, yes.
And everything is planned through Nyx.
Dang.
Yeah.
So...
And Cressley's married, right? So there's hope for me with my murder wall.
Yes,
I think so.
Man, podcast over. Like,
so
what else can we
that
say?
That is the information I got. And when I got it, I gasped aloud because I felt like I needed like extra air. I got really excited about having access to this murder wall, which I'm sure I will never have. But if anybody, you know, lives near Cressley or gets an opportunity to, like, attend a party or function at her house.
Break in, maybe. Could, like, I don't know.
You know, break away and try and search for a bathroom. Go looking for a murder wall. And, you know, Jen and I will pay you in romance novels and I don't
accolades,
know.
Accolades. I'm not sure or what.
Yeah. Golden Girls bobbleheads or something.
I have three of the same Golden Girls sweatshirt, I'll donate Sunburned Dorothy.
There you go. Color.
Her,
great.
Her face printed too red, so I got another one.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's actually kind of amazing. But it doesn't surprise me because of the way all this stuff, like...
But it has to be, right? So, like, because if you think of all the times that she's left an item on the table,
yeah.
Right? The Thrain's key, the, like, all the, like, little... The little things that she can ultimately bring in at the end and use, having like some beastie escaped from the weird demon's belly in this book is a really valuable thing.
Sure.
And it's such a like, you know, like off the cuff comment. Like it's not, unless you're looking for stuff, which I was, I think it totally would have slipped my mind.
Well, and what do we know about that beast? What do we know about it?
It very much reminded me, can I tell you this, of the Matrix. Do you guys, like the first Matrix?
Yes.
Right? So
totally. I had that same feel.
Right? Because you're like plugged in and like essentially this beast is feeding on you and it's feeding on immortals. There's other immortals trapped in there. And because their energy is essentially like nonstop. And so the...
But we don't know what this beast is.
Nope. Mm-mm. Just something in...
Do we even know how they got in there?
In hell.
No. It was a portal. Nyx... No, it wasn't a portal. It was a... It was one of those accidental like places in hell in Pandemonia. But Nyx whispers where she is, where they are into Thronos's ear.
Yeah. And he is terrified.
And that's all we get. So he knows where they are.
Well, and that's when we think he traces, right? Because we don't think he makes it through the portal. We think he traces. Whoa, couldn't say that word.
Yeah.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, that part was...
Anyway.
Yeah.
If anybody... That is a great question, though, Samantha. And if any of our listeners have an idea as to what escapes the beast with them... Please hit us up on Twitter at Faded Mates, on Instagram at Faded Mates Pod. You can leave a comment on this episode at fadedmates.net. Samantha, tell everybody how they can find you.
You can find me at Books by SS, like a ship, Jackson, Jaxon, on Twitter. And then I think my Instagram's the same.
You guys, you know who escaped with them? It was probably Keanu Reeves. It's fine.
Yeah, where did he come from?
I was like, I know the truth. He unplugged from the Matrix, he took the right colored pill, and now he's John Wick. It's fine, everybody. Fine.
Samantha, it's always awesome hanging out with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
And we can't wait to read your book.
Me either.
We will send you love letters to your P.O. box.
Oh, thanks. That's so nice.
All right, everybody. We'll see you next time on Faded Mates.
Yeah, he's attractive. He's like gone back to his speed ways.
He has some funky facial hair though, y'all.
Not everyone can grow up with you.
It's not that he can't grow a full beard, it's that it's growing up the side of his face in some interesting patterns.